Home Stage Podcast. I'm Jordan Ralph.
And I'm Dan Becker.
And today we're going to talk about Matthew Vaughn's Kick-Ass. But first we have some news stories. Today it was actually announced, or yesterday. It was announced that James Bond, number 23, has been suspended indefinitely.
Because of MGM not picking good projects that make any money.
Yes, yeah. That was the main reason.
Among many other things.
They talked, you know, Sam Mendes was going to direct the next one. They had a writer attached, but since dropped out.
Well, Peter Morgan.
But then, like, there was a news story that, like, they're going to be a whole new rewrite and stuff. That was, like, a week before the story came out.
Really?
And, but it was set to be released in 2011 or 2012, but now it's...
Now, what was the movie that Sam Mendes dropped off of because of Bond?
Preacher.
Preacher, right?
Yeah.
Which, I'm going to be honest, I've read a couple of those graphic novels. Mm. And I am not... it's a pretty cool premise, but... I do not think they're well written, to be completely honest. So I remember being kind of happy about that, just because I'd much rather see another Bond film than a Preacher film.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of sad news because now it seems like he has no projects. And, you know, I was liking Sam Mendes every year, you know, because it was Revolutionary Road, and then literally 8 months later, away we go. So.
Yeah. But, I mean, today it just announced that he is going to direct Oz, the Great and Powerful, with Robert Downey Jr. to star.
Right,
and it's kind of funny. This news came out the day after that Bond has been suspended, so it sounds like they've been...
Well, I'm sure he's a guy who has just a lot of offers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Probably just scores of screenplays sitting on his desk.
Yeah.
Or his assistant's desk, you know?
Yeah. If Oz, the Great and Powerful is was originally called Brick, but obviously, you know, they changed the name because of Rian Johnson's film. The script takes the idea that the wizard is transported to Oz from Kansas, and how he came to be
like an origin story of Oz.
Yeah, kind of like
an Oz origin story.
That'd be kind of cool if Robert Downey Jr.
An Azorigin story,
yes,
if you will.
And Daniel Craig, he has a ton of awesome projects coming up. He's going to be with Harrison Ford in Cowboys and Aliens, right. And then Adventures of Tintin, Steven Spielberg, and then he's in Dreamhouse, Jim Sheridan's.
No, that's right. So. Yeah, with Naomi Watts, right?
Yeah. So he's a busy guy. So, I'm not after Quantum of Solace, which was one of my biggest disappointments of that year.
Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those things. I was talking to Connor, our friend Connor, who's been on the last couple of podcasts, and we were talking about James Bond and just kind of the trajectory of the films. And we were saying how right now, I would argue that Daniel Craig and Pierce Brosnan are neck and neck in second best Bond. And that it's kind of funny because you had Pierce Brosnan had GoldenEye, which was a really great first film directed by Martin Campbell. Daniel Craig had Casino Royale, which is a very good first film directed by Martin Campbell. And then both of them had kind of mediocre second films, Tomorrow Never Dies, Quantum of Solace, and then it only got worse for Pierce Brosnan. Brosnan then made The World's Not Enough and Died Another Day, so it just kind of kept getting a little bit worse. And I feel like, you know, Daniel Craig, it all comes down to this, you know, this third movie. If it can be better, then The World Is Not Enough, which, I mean, I'd hope it would be, then, you know, he can really kind of stake his claim as, you know, a memorable Bond, definitely. So, I don't know. But anyway.
When Sam Mendes got attached, I was really excited. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, like, thought it was a terrible choice, but I think he would...
Well, the only reason I think it might not be the best choice is because they already kind of went... They already did the out-of-the-box thing with Mark Forster, and it did not go well, so... You know, and like, I mean, and, you know, kind of similarly, the same conversation I was having earlier, we were talking about Mission Impossible versus James Bond and how the thing about Mission Impossible is you know who directed those films because the whole point, like, Tom Cruise has always made it a point to have each director have their own very specific vision of a Mission Impossible movie. And, you know, and then, so when you take that and then you compare it to James Bond, I could only name you... three directors of James Bond movies, you know, and that's just only because of recent knowing everything, you know, trying to know as much as possible. You know, and that's, I think, part of the reason why Quantum of Solace failed, because people weren't comfortable with the out-of-the-boxness, producers, fans, what have you, because James Bond is a comfortable franchise.
Yeah.
So I just kind of think, you know, Sam Mendes has a very specific style, So I just don't know. You know what I mean? I feel curious.
Like, I mean, I know MGM's not doing well, but like this is the longest running film series in history. Hmm. And even Quantum of Solace was the most successful. So
yeah, but I mean the most successful but also the most expensive by 50 million. That's true, yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like one of those things where, and remember, yeah, it's the longest running franchise and, you know, the most films to its name and da 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 da. But I mean, that is because there is a formula that literally every single Bond film follows. And I'm not slamming the franchise with that. I'm saying, because Mark Forster clearly tried to do some things differently, and I don't even know if he was given a chance to fail. I just think it was kind of almost as soon as, you know, they came to the surface, I think people just didn't really know how to properly react. So
yeah.
I don't know. You know, we'll see. But I guess we won't be really seeing it for a long time. So
yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, if they said 2012, like, I mean, 2 more years at least, yeah. I would think.
I do like that Daniel Craig though isn't kind. I mean, Daniel Craig, he's James Bond, but he's also a lot of other things. Like when Pierce Brosnan was James Bond, that was all it was really. He kind of didn't do much else. I mean, and even his other movies.
He was
James Bond, you know, Thomas Crown Affair and whatnot. So, I mean, I like that, you know, Daniel Craig's doing different things like Defiance, you know, where it's a completely different character. And Cowboys and Aliens seems like it'll be a very different Dreamhouse thriller, you know. So just, I mean, he's making really good career decisions, I feel like.
Definitely. All right, well, we'll keep you updated on the Bond series.
Definitely.
All right, let's move on to our next story, The Tree of Life. Now, this is Terrence Malick's next film.
Yeah, the best.
Yes, and probably my most anticipated outside. I mean, Summer Rise, Inception,
and Tree of Life, right up there.
Tree of Life, yeah. And so this was announced, definitely not coming to Cannes, and a lot of people expected that after it was supposed to come out last winter. But
yeah, but of course, I mean Terrence Malick. This movie might not come out until 2012.
Yeah,
I mean, for all we know.
So we got a few more details last week. Brad Pitt talked to Empire, and I kind of we knew a little bit about it before because like there's this Voyage of Time.
Which people thought might be two movies.
Yeah, but
another part. Yeah.
Yeah. So Brad Pitt said it's kind of this other story juxtaposed with it's a tiny little story of the micro story of the cosmos from the beginning of the cosmos to the death of the cosmos, and it's in like IMAX 70mm. I can't wait to see.
No, this is the beginning of the film. Is that the idea?
I would expect it would open with that, but it's throughout the story. It's they go back and forth. So I'm sure like there's a lot of connections throughout the story.
That's really interesting.
I mean, we don't really. All we know is about a story of a kid growing up in the 50s and kind of experiencing life and experiencing all like your first thing, like first love, first death, first thing. So it sounds epic, but
Terrence Malick movie epic. I do not see it.
but over on Slash Film, someone posted. It was I told you Vincent Gallo saw the film. It was actually in a Vincent Gallo story.
Who the fuck is Vincent Gallo?
Wasn't. It was a commenter that actually saw it, not Vincent Gallo. It was in a Vincent Gallo story talking about. I guess Vincent Gallo mentioned that small thing about Tree of Life or about Terrence Malick.
We actually didn't see it.
It was someone that
good.
Yeah, it was good. About no, this kidding. Guy named Stan. That he goes by Stan. And
I know Stan.
Yeah, he worked for a company, I guess, that did visual effects work on it. And Malick screened the film to about 30 people, and his boss was there, and so was the Tree of Life cinematographer, Emmanuel Lubezki.
Right.
Who's done a lot of cool stuff. But they said it's 97% done, but it's not going to make Cannes.
How did they get the 90? Out of curiosity. Maybe Terrence Malick said it is 97% done.
Yeah. And but he said it's his best film, so it's Badlands, which is, I mean... Do you think Badlands is his best movie? Would you say?
No, I mean, I think I mean, personally, I my favorite movie of his is probably The New World. But I mean, I think saying that Badlands is his best, I mean, you know, they're all great. I don't know. It's hard to say. But Badlands is definitely his most narratively compelling film. You know, like the story is the most, like, it's the most contained story, mm-hmm. I guess.
I've never seen it. It's like a better
version of Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
That's essentially what it is. So, I mean, I guess if you were thinking about it, like, in very traditional terms, it's his best constructed movie. But I mean, yeah. So anyway, yeah. I mean,
and this guy Stan said, like, he, you know, he works for a visual effects house, and he said most movies, you know, that they work with the director, they don't really see the director. They get these orders passed down.
He's in Paris. Yeah. Getting them emails what to do, right?
Wes Anderson style. No. Mm, and exactly. Nobody said with Terrence Malick, like, he literally talked to every visual effects artist, got, like, he said he didn't really reveal much of the plot, but he just told them what he wanted. So, right, like, they only know about the Voyage of Time elements.
That's cool,
said,
though.
I mean, but he said it's so, like, this last part they have, it's so time-consuming, because IMAX 70mm, it takes a lot of time.
Obviously, that's awesome to hear, though. You know, like, I keep wondering why more films, you know, because you have this 3D push, and I just think it's funny because all these IMAX theaters are getting built. Why not start? I don't know. I mean,
start with the resolution.
Yeah, why not start shooting? Shooting IMAX. I mean, I mean, just because I think it's funny how The Dark Knight's still really one of the only feature films to really, really utilize IMAX the way it did.
It really is only. I mean, everything else is just.
They can be in IMAX theaters, but that kind of doesn't really mean that much, really. So it's like. But anyway, I like that Terrence Malick, seems to be kind of ahead of the curve, which is interesting.
Do you think, let's say this comes out, November is what Apparition is releasing instead of the
Bob Bernie Bentley.
Do you think this is going to, like, would this have a big, because usually IMAX theaters have these big blockbusters, do you think this will even have an audience?
I don't know, I mean, usually his films get the platform releases, like the last two, Thin Red Line and The New World got, limited eventual wide based on awards, but like that, The New World never really got too wide because it didn't get much recognition. But I mean, I guess with Brad Pitt and Sean Penn in it,
I would love to see a Malick movie, like, totally.
I think that Days of Heaven got a significant amount of attention theatrically. I could be completely wrong, but I mean, I just based on. Because that movie, that movie literally sustained his reputation for 20 years. Yeah. So, but we're looking at it now, and it just says $3.5 million. So, I mean, even in 1978, that really wasn't a lot of money. So, I think the thing about Terrence Malick is he's a guy where movies are a business, first and foremost, of course, and, any executive will tell you that, but. And they'll also tell you for every Iron Man 2, they would hope to have the money to lose making the Tree of Life.
Yeah.
Like, for street cred.
Yeah.
I would think. So, just Or at least to distribute the Tree of Life. Yeah. I mean, maybe not produce it, obviously. He gets, all of his movies are independently financed. Yeah. But, I mean, to just have their name on it.
Yeah. It's so funny, because, IMAX is usually related with the blockbuster experience.
Right, I know what you're saying.
A movie like, There Will Be Blood, like, a lot of people,
did well.
Okay, yeah. And, but, like, I mean, a lot, I feel like that will, that's a film that's going to grow and on DVD and people are going to realize if a Malick movie comes out on IMAX, or people, we'll go see it, and, like, the people that saw There Will Be Blood will see it, and then, like, then you have it, then it just comes out on DVD, and then it never gets the recognition deserves an IMAX.
I think it's interesting, because I do think it is interesting, because what movies are going to be in IMAX in November? Right. I mean, is there going to be competition? I can't imagine there will be.
There's always a dream. It's Megamind. That's not.
Megamind is. I don't think it's that late. But I mean, yeah, that's true though. Is that IMAX though?
There's not a lot of like block. I know. Like last year we saw Avatar. Obviously, that was the massive one. Gulliver's Travels is a big. Rob Letterman, who did Monsters vs. Aliens. I don't know. That's with Jack Black. I don't know if that's actually going to IMAX, but.
I mean, that's a 3D, though.
Tron Legacy. That's the big one.
Yeah, but when is that
December 18th, so it's not. Oh. So, yeah, that'll be huge. That'll
Tron Legacy comes out in December? Yeah. I thought that was, like, a summer movie.
No.
Wow.
No, December 17th.
Wow.
And then Harry Potter, the month before. I feel like Tree of Life is not going to.
Jesus Christ, dude. It's kind of. Can I just say, it's kind of funny how the summer is kind of. It's kind of, like, changing.
Yeah.
I think. It's funny.
After Avatar, the highest grossing movie made all that money in just December, I feel like there's kind of a shift.
Yeah, but it's funny because, you look back how Jaws in 1975 literally took all those big movies and put them into the summer. And then, here we are 35 years later, and they're still big movies. But even if you look at the summer lineup this year, I don't know. I mean, the movies aren't, like, there's nothing bigger in the summer coming out than Harry Potter. You know what I mean? I just think it's kind of interesting.
Well, like, the biggest movie, Harry Potter, is coming out. Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah.
So that's not coming out in Tron, summer. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and Tron's going to be a huge movie, too. So it's just kind of interesting, I think.
I mean, it is. But, like, we, like, with with December, the last couple of years, I've seen two big movies, like, you know, Avatar, Sherlock Holmes.
Right, they both did great.
Yeah,
but like, next to each other.
Yeah, and like, but like,
and Squeakquel. Don't forget about Squeakquel.
But like, but I know what you mean. But in the summer, though, at least every week, there's kind of a big budget.
That, like, yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously, it's still like that. But I'm just saying, I don't know. It's just kind of interesting. I mean, like, even you see, you know, Clash of the Titans came out in March.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know, things are changing in that respect. I don't know. So it's kind of Shutter Island came out in February, right? Yeah. So it's like, I mean, both of those films did well. So
I mean, if we could get solid films all year round,
that'd be awesome. No, sure.
Happy for that. All right. So let's we'll keep you updated on Tree of Life. I hope. I mean, maybe they do a trailer premiere. That'd be awesome. I mean, you said when you went there, do you think they would?
If it's not 100%,
there was a lot of like trailer, like promo trailers.
Oh, you mean like posters and the promotional stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, is Apparition going to be there?
Yeah.
That's the thing. I don't know. Where are they going to be? Do they have anything? Because last year they had Brightstar.
Yeah.
But see, I don't even know if they'd picked it up by then.
Did Twilight Eclipse, it didn't get in competition at Cannes?
No, I missed.
You missed out.
I know. It's really, my fingers were crossed.
I know.
I thought
I was going to take the Palme d'Or.
Palme d'Or, yeah.
Well, there's always Breaking Dawn.
Is always Breaking Dawn. Both films.
All right, well, let's move on to a Cannes 2011.
Please.
To a Cannes 2011 premiere.
Oh.
That's what they're shooting for.
Oh, Lars von Trier, definitely.
Yeah, this
he
film,
always does again.
This film is Lars von Trier's Melancholia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a psychological disaster film, is how he's selling it.
Good for you.
And first it was announced, I mean, Penelope Cruz was like a maybe in it, but then
right.
She decided to do Pirates of the Caribbean instead.
A wise choice.
Wise choice.
You know, I mean, it's really...
stuff.
Yeah.
And but no, and so now we have Kirsten Dunst.
Kirsten.
And what do you think about this lead in a Lars von Trier movie?
Well, I mean, she's never had success as a lead. But, I mean, it's a Lars von Trier... It's a Lars von Trier movie, so I would imagine... I would hope she gets pushed the same way that Nicole Kidman got pushed in Dogville, you know? And, you know, Bryce Dallas Howard got pushed in Mandalay, and Bjork got pushed in Dance in the Dark, and you know, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and Andy Christian.
Who is also Charlotte Gainsbourg, will be joining her in this
film. Oh, really? Oh,
that's good. And Kiefer Sutherland.
Stellan Skarsgård,
yep.
Who was in Breaking the Waves, which was, like, von Trier's breakout film.
They said this, it's going to be a $5 million production that's going to shoot July through September in southern Sweden.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
There's not too many details about it, but, I mean, I know a lot of people were divided on Antichrist. I still think it's, like, pretty good grade.
Oh, yeah, no, I think it's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know,
and if
the fact that people talk about it, it's important. You know, it's important people talk about movies, whether they hate them or love them, so
and,
that's great.
And it's also actually on Netflix, watching Sleep, so you can watch it with the whole family if you want to.
Antichrist,
yeah.
Oh my God.
It's a nice...
I think me and my 12-year-old brother are going to watch
it. Let me know how that goes.
It'll be like an anatomy lesson and also... and a lesson on how never to touch anatomy after he watches it. So, it'll be good.
I mean, the one thing we know, which is expected, he said, the film will have no more happy endings.
See, what I think is funny is, like, no more. So, there were. But the implication being that at some point in the filmic career of von Trier, there were happy endings.
Yeah.
I think he's being sarcastic.
I don't know.
If my intuition serves me right.
They said it's in reference to Planet Macaulay. Melancholia, which is an enormous planet that evidently looms threateningly close to Earth.
Oh, really? For real?
Yeah.
Like in real life?
Yeah. So,
huh. Like Armageddon?
Yeah. So it's going to be Armageddon, too.
So it's going to be like Armageddon?
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, no, that's all that's been released, but shooting soon, so hopefully we'll get some more details, and I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And, like we said, they're shooting for a Cannes 2011 premiere. So we will report back with news on that.
Well, that is good to hear. More von Trier is always nice.
Yes. All right, so let's move on to Darren Aronofsky. Literally any Darren Aronofsky story.
Speaking of more of something good.
Yeah.
Anything Aronofsky is.
So he's finishing up Black Swan with Natalie Portman.
Can't wait.
Vincent Cassell. And it's not going to show Cannes, another movie that...
Obviously
in Toronto, like we saw. But
I mean, yeah, What festivals does Aronofsky hold? You know what I mean? Because usually the way it works with a lot of directors is like
keep coming back to the
ones that made them. You know, von Trier and what the fuck is his name? Oh, My Blueberry Nights.
Wong Kar-wai.
He always comes back. They both always come back. Fucking Park Chan-wook. Ang Lee, right? Album, yeah. So you know, but
So he's going to finish that up. He's finishing up now, and probably Fox Searchlight is doing it again, so we'll see that.
Black Swan?
Black Swan, yeah.
Good for him.
And But he also, we reported a couple weeks ago that he has a project set up with Angelina Jolie, that kind of weird...
Antichrist sounding project,
Project. And he also has a new RoboCop up, but it'll never get made. But,
yeah, I don't know.
But anyway, so now
he also has the Noah's Ark movie, which would be the greatest thing to ever see made.
He also described a world's biggest heist film that he's planning. That was a couple
weeks ago. True.
But it sounds like he's not going to do any of those projects.
Instead, he's going to do... Jackie.
He's going to direct his... fiance.
Is she still? I thought they're not married yet.
Yeah, no.
I've only been dating for like 75 years.
Rachel Weisz, who was in The Fountain.
Yeah. Which is his best movie.
Definitely. Hands down. And this film is Jackie. It was written by Noah Oppenheim, who used to be like a developmental head at Revell, the TV production company.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And he wrote the script, and Steven Spielberg was kind of shopping around.
Right, I remember that. Yeah.
And it's
Jackie Onassis.
It's about the immediate days following President Kennedy's assassination. And
That's what it's about? It's about that?
Yeah, and it says, it would take place over 4 days between his assassination and his burial, showing the beloved Jackie at both her most vulnerable and her most graceful. So it's kind of interesting.
I kind of wish it was more just about her, though. That's kind of funny. I guess I really didn't read that story as much as I thought it. That's funny.
I mean, we saw Darren Ruskin, the wrestler, kind of do this character, you know.
Yeah, portrait.
And
right,
so it seems like it's kind of...
And also Pi was essentially a character portrait, too. I mean, really, that was... But
because when I first read the story, I was like, really? Jackie Kennedy? Like, Darren Aronofsky? It's interesting, but it's not a movie. Like, the four other movies you described would kind of seem more like
his. But I'll say this, though. I mean, consider the women in his films. From what I can tell, he directs women better than most directors. Mm. You know? Because it's like, I mean, in all of his films, I mean, maybe not Pi, because Pi is so contained, but like, Jennifer Connelly is incredible in Requiem for a Dream. Sure. Rachel Weisz is incredible in The Fountain. Marissa Tomei is great.
Do you think Evan Rachel Wood was amazing?
She was rough. I've always not disliked that performance, but like, I mean, for the most part, I feel like he really tries to get the most out of actresses, because you watch a lot of movies, and kind of similar to Von Trier, in that respect. You watch a lot of movies, like people like Martin Scorsese. I mean, the fact that the best performance he ever got out of a woman was probably in Goodfellas, I guess you could argue, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Cate Blanchett.
Cate Blanchett, maybe in The Aviator. But I mean, the point is, they're good. They're good performances for sure. But like, Darren Aronofsky, really, I don't know. So I'm interested, he hasn't made a movie. But then, furthermore, Black Swan is about two female leads. Yeah. So I will really get
actually,
to see.
Remember when Black Swan announced, I didn't think
we were surprised, too. Yeah. But I think that we'll really see how he can really do that.
And Rachel Weisz, really give her more.
Totally. No, she is one of the most reliable actresses working today. Yeah.
We'll keep up to date on that. And
I'm still waiting to see Gora. I really want, it's been getting very mediocre reviews, but she's in it, so.
And speaking of Martin Scorsese,
look at us, we're just, it's like not even fair.
So, Martin Scorsese's next movie is going to be Hugo Cabaret, which Ben Kingsley, Sacha Baron Cohen,
Claude Moretz,
and there's another kid. That's
whatever. some other fucking kid.
And it's confirmed to be in 3D. So,
which I'm curious about,
He's kind of like the first, really accomplished. Like, really, well, James Cameron, obviously.
Steven fucking Spielberg.
That's true.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, I can see, because Steven Spielberg's all about
The blockbuster. Art director or
kind
something?
Kind of. I'm trying to think of another art like.
Well, I mean, don't forget, Wim Wenders did that 3D indie film.
Yeah.
Right?
It was just a short,
but still, though, yeah. I mean, that was something that Wenders is like the art director.
Yeah.
Martin Scorsese. But I mean, things have been being announced all the time about it, though. I mean, you have Fincher shooting in 4K. Yeah. I mean,
in 3D. I can tell directors.
I'm just saying, I mean, everybody's making the move. But you're right, though. I mean, for someone who is of the film, someone who literally pays thousands upon millions, blah, 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 dollars to restore films like The Red Shoes. 3D. Interesting.
And then that movie actually got a release date of December 9th, 2011.
Hugo Cabret?
Yep.
What?
So it won't be too long before he sees Scorsese again.
That's nice.
But another movie that was actually announced a while, like
it's been around for a long time. Yeah.
And it was originally called "I Heard You Paint Houses," and it is about it's kind of a gangster flick with.
Well, it's based on a book about a real life a real life hitman
who carried out more than 25 hits. And they
it kind of sounds like Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, except more obviously straightforward.
Yeah, and in a recent news story, Robert De Niro, who's attached to the project, he set some plans for the films, and he said that he's probably going to make it in two parts, and the first part would kind of be, like, the film that it was set out to be, and then the second part would be, like, this, it's about, like, the relate. It seems like they're not really related in terms of content-wise, but they said, like,
it would maybe it would be, like, a making of a film similar to that.
He said it'd be, like, a Fellini-inspired, like, he's based on the things Marty and I have experienced and kind of overlapping them. And they compared it to 8.5 and like Dolce Vita. And,
right, because for those who don't know, 8.5 is about a director who is trying to make this movie, but he hasn't written the screenplay, and I mean, it's a lot of, reflects on the women in his life, and it's a meta film, the meta film.
I mean, in a lot of respects. Just watch Dolce Vita. Nine to get that.
Right. Yeah, no, don't watch 9. Just watch 8.5. No, and then La Dolce Vita is a completely different movie, but it stars Marcello Mastroianni as a gossip photographer, essentially, a paparazzi, who, it's a similar story, except it's not meta. It's essentially just like, you know, about a guy who has to deal with these women. But like, for example, if my memory serves, there is a scene in 9 that is directly from La Dolce Vita.
Oh, so it kind of combines.
So, I mean, that essentially, if 9 is a culmination of those two, a horrible culmination of those two great films, I think probably Fellini's two best films, actually, that I've seen.
I haven't seen La Strada.
Yeah, La Strada, I mean, it's great too. Yeah. But Martin Scorsese actually loves La Strada. I remember he did some commentary for that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Or he did an introduction to the DVD for La Strada, the Criterion. But, they do something like that, where, like, unrelated but related, you know, because they come out, like, 2 years apart, whatever the fuck, like, that would be incredible.
It's interesting, because they said, you know, Steve Zaillian, who did American Gangster, right, and he did...
Steve Zaillian wrote Schindler's List.
Schindler's List, that's right.
American Gangster, he wrote and directed All the King's Men.
Yes, that's right. And, so he wrote the first script for this, the straight kind of story.
Right. I heard
and then they're getting Eric Roth.
Right.
He's supposed to write the second, which he did.
Which I don't understand, because he's such a straightforward writer.
Yeah.
So he's going to write the meta film?
As I said, he's supposed to do it.
That's interesting.
And we're hoping to move these things together. That was the quote.
He wrote Munich, which is kind of a little bit of a departure.
That's true.
So,
So Scorsese starts production on Hugo Cabaret, and, but then he said they're going to move on to Silence first, which is the priest
With Benicio and Gael Garcia. Yeah.
So we won't see this movie for a while, but it's kind of interesting to see.
They're getting old, man. They got to make this movie soon.
It's like, Nick Newman, one of our writers, like, tweeted when Shutter Island didn't come out. He's like, there's actually not that many films left, like, for Scorsese. Like,
Well, we were talking about how many Scorsese movies we'd seen in theaters, and I'd seen 3, you'd seen 2 after Shutter Island. And that kind of surprised me, because you think, you know, how many more will you see? Probably no more than 4. Yeah. I mean, it usually takes them a few years. I mean, I guess we could have seen Shine a Light. I don't know.
I saw the movie. I haven't seen theaters.
But yeah. You did see the movie? Was it good?
After watching The Last Waltz, like, when I saw Shine a Light, I was like, oh, that was good. And then I saw The Last Waltz, and it feels so much more real. And like,
yeah, but was Shine a Light trying to be like The Last Waltz? I thought it was more of like a concert doc.
I mean, it's kind of an IMAX.
Right. Like,
but there's no like, it's not, I don't know, but that's what, I mean, The Last Waltz is kind of a...
Yeah, but it isn't The Last Waltz. The Last Waltz is like 3 hours long.
No, it's like 2.
Really?
Yeah,
I've seen it, actually. Huh?
No, it doesn't matter,
but yeah. All right, well, yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Shine a Light, but anyway, the point being...
Rolling Stones, but no.
He actually, though, Scorsese does have a Jim Morrison documentary coming out, I think, next year. I mean, I think it's done, actually, so I don't know when.
He just does those on the weekend.
On the weekend, he's like, all right, let's make another rock documentary, whatever.
But, no, I'm definitely, can't wait for all of these movies that he's...
Oh, yeah, I mean, Silence, at first I was a little skeptical, but also, what about the Sinatra biopic, right? Didn't you want to make that, too, with Leo? And then also... The Theodore Roosevelt biopic you wanted to do?
That's right. Damn, that guy.
He
just needs to call himself.
Exactly.
Moonstyle, spoilers. All right.
Seriously.
What I just watched last night again. It's a great movie. On the second viewing. Anyways, moving on to our review of Matthew Vaughn.
I forgot we're doing this. Okay. Kick-Ass.
Matthew Vaughn's Kick-Ass.
Kick-Ass.
Now, this is probably one of the most heavily anticipated movies of the year.
Yep.
And it was released, you know, 3 weeks ago in Britain. Britain finally
doing well in Britain.
Yeah. And finally we get it to see it in the U.S.
Yes, we do.
Now, basic story is based on the Mark Millar.
I think it's Mark Miller.
It's weird. I actually read an article. It's all about the pronunciation of his name. And American people pronounce it Millar. But the correct pronunciation is Millar. But in Britain, they just because of their accent, they pronounce it Miller. It's kind of weird. I don't know. Anyway, so Dan and I, we both read the comic beforehand. Yes, a couple weeks before. Or graphic novel. Whatever. Same thing.
Yeah, and it was graphic.
Certainly
graphic.
And it was the comic actually started in February 2008, and it actually the production was going side by side, and the production actually finished before the graphic novel, the last four graphic novels actually came out, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And so Matthew Vaughn worked with Mark Miller to write it, and also Jane Goldman, who is a partner with Vaughn. She worked with Stardust the comic book and the story of the movie surrounds Dave Lizweski. Yeah, and he is played by Aaron Johnson. He decides one day, he's kind of a nerd, decides one day put on a suit and just go for it.
Yep.
And that's the basic story. Now Dan, what'd you think of Kick-Ass?
I guess just based on the whole Comic-Con thing, you know, the way that Matthew Vaughn went about showing the footage without anyone having, you know, no one had bought it, and, you know, there was a whole frenzy at Comic-Con, and Lionsgate jumped on it, and the whole bidding war, and they won, and this, that, and the third, everyone was really excited about it, all this. Matthew Vaughn is a very capable producer, probably even more capable director. I enjoyed Layer Cake, a very, very strong movie, and I love Stardust, actually. I was definitely anticipating this movie a lot, and, you know, I did not disappoint me at all, but there are things about it that I think really prevent it from being, I don't know, important, you know, like prevent it from being kind of anything more than just a fun ride, a fun, violent, bloody ride. And I guess Matthew Vaughn really wasn't intending to do more, and I guess that's fine, but I mean, it was almost disappointing just because that was all it was, you know? So, I don't know, what you think?
Yeah, like, I mean, before this came out, people were like, this is gonna change the way superhero genre is. Like, after this, people will think superhero movies are so silly. I don't think it does that. I don't think it...
Right, I mean, that's the thing. Listen, we were talking about this. This is the world we live in right now where, I mean, there's this hype. You know, you're never going to go into a film the way that people went into Raiders of the Lost Ark or Jaws, where you really didn't know what to expect. You had this, you know, a great poster or something, and you were like, wow, Han Solo. Like, what's this movie about? And you're blown away by the boulder, blown away by the opening sequence in Jaws, blown away by the score, da-da-da-da-da. I mean, by the time fucking movies like this come out, you're expecting just something that's beyond possibility. You know, I feel like you're expecting Citizen Kane or something like that. You know what I mean? So it's like, the same thing happened with Watchmen, I feel like. And even though these two movies are different, they're very similar, you know, in the way that they were sold, even though Watchmen wasn't really a comedy. I mean, it's kind of the same kind of thing, like superheroes without powers, what does it mean to be a superhero, kind of da-da-da-da-da, like all, you know, this kind of stuff. But and you know, obviously Kick-Ass is a lighter version of that, 75% of the time. But there are, yeah. And this is the biggest problem with the movie, and this is what a lot of people have been saying. Tonally, it's ridiculous. I don't even know. I mean, I'm sure they watched the movie, and I'm not trying. And I did very much enjoy it, but there are scenes that are seriously like violent and like not. I mean, they're fun, I guess, but like they're violent, like disturbingly violent, like violent to the point when I was in the theater watching it, and there was a score going on. Like, for example, there's a scene in the film where they use John Murphy's 28 Days Later score, and you know, 28 Days Later was an intense movie, and so this is an intense score, and you have this character just literally going around and just fucking like killing people, like, and I was watching it and I was enjoying myself, but
in a completely different way from the rest of the movie before that. I was actually thinking, like, wow, this is, like, intense. Like, this is real. Like, whoa. And then, minutes later, people are joking about it. Like, you know, people in the film are joking about stuff that's happening, and I'm confused, because now I'm like, well, this is funny. It's legitimately funny, but how am I supposed to feel about this? Like, is this a satire? I mean, this is Roger Ebert's. Obviously, he gave the movie 1 star, kind of infamous already about that. I mean, he gave the movie 1 star, and his biggest problem was that he said it was he could tell that it was a satire, but of what exactly? I think the biggest problem with the movie is that I couldn't tell if it was a satire, and I don't think that Mark Miller or Matthew Vaughn really could either. And yeah, so I mean, that at its core kind of renders it like every other superhero movie at the end of the day, because, you know, I mean, it's not as, you know, for example, The Dark Knight had a message, you know, and, you know, it wasn't satirical or anything, but I mean, it had a message, and it stayed on the message. That kind of dark tone is maintained throughout the film, and this had maintained nothing, and that, so, I don't know, it was confusing.
No, I agree about it. I mean, my initial comment made it seem like I didn't like it that much, but I did. I think I liked it a little more than you.
Yeah, I'm not.
Like, I really, like, love this movie. Like, I love everything about it. Right. And, like, I totally see if someone... I understand Roger Ebert hating it. I understand if you go see it and you hate it.
Right.
Like, I totally get that. I understand, like, all the problems with it. But it's one of those movies where, like, there's so much that I love about it. That right. And consistently, too. Like, a lot of people say the beginning's boring, but I love the setup. Right. You know, I love all the action set pieces. You know, everything about it, it's just a hell of a good time. But I agree with Dan, you know, there's the message at the end. There's nothing, at the end, you're left.
Well, it just, like, for example, and I think this is an interesting movie pop culturally to observe reactions to, because people like Michael Phillips, Roger Ebert, A.O. Scott, okay, these more, I'm sure Rex Reed hated it, I don't know, but I mean, like, these more traditional movie critics, None of them really dug it that much, and meanwhile, people like Harry Knowles, people like Devin Faraci, people like yourself, you know, loved the shit out of it, right? You know, really enjoyed it for legitimate reasons. But and so then you had what Harry Knowles wrote,
the response
to Roger Ebert, comparing his criticizing Chloe Moretz to Robert Ebert's defending Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver. And I think that kind of what gets lost in translation is, you know, Taxi Driver had a message. It was a film that had a trajectory, that knew where it was going. Okay, a very, very confident kind of pace and very specific, you know, on point to be made.
I mean, and also Kick-Ass. Chloe Moretz is literally, like, killing people, swearing with in Taxi Driver. I don't think it's as...
Well, but I mean, she's a hooker. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but
I mean,
there's no...
But I mean, like, she... I don't know. I mean, and no she's scene. Present while Robert De Niro does horrible things to people.
That's true.
So, I mean, yeah, granted. Yeah. I guess if you consider... if you consider 30 years... You know, and just kind of how violence, you know, it gets
escalates.
I mean, it's probably a similar thing. But what I think is interesting about it is, I think Kick-Ass really speaks to the ADD age that we live in, right? Because it's almost like it's all over the place.
It is, yeah.
It's all over the place. You know, you have this going on and this going on, this joke, and it's all well done, but none of it really connects completely. And people like us and like these, you know, and people who run film blogs and whatnot, you know, people who literally live and die by how fast you can copy news stories, you know, rather than how many fucking grammatical errors you have.
Yeah.
Like, these are the people who are defending this movie, you know. And granted, on Rotten Tomatoes, it's at 78%, so it's not like they're the only people, but I'm saying, you know, these are the people that are defending the box office draw, you know, the low box office draw. These are the people defending, you know, criticizing Lionsgate for how it was marketed. Meanwhile, people like Michael Phillips and, you know, these other people, these more traditional, like, film critics, are kind of just, they're reviewing it and then moving on. Because
yeah.
I don't think they really care that much about it.
Yeah.
Kind of like Watchmen,
yeah, exactly.
You know. And I just think it's interesting because it speaks to just how things are changing, you know, these traditional film critics as they get rendered more and more kind of unnecessary. I think, in a way, it makes me a little sad because, you know, for me, Kick-Ass, though it was a great experience and I did really enjoy the hell out of it, it felt like immediate satisfaction, you know, very masturbatory, you know what I mean? Like, it happened, I loved it, but now I kind of don't, like, you know what I mean? I feel like if I watched it again, it would just kind of be tired. I mean, not tired, I would enjoy
it. The shock value is gone. That's a lot of movies.
Yeah,
like
I mean,
that.
It would be, there would probably be something I could find to love in it, but, like, that initial kick just won't be there. Whereas with Taxi Driver, you know, or films of that nature, you go back and you just find things that just make it iconic and just forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And this movie just doesn't have that. Like, and for example, Stardust is, you know, probably more traditional in storytelling, but more fully realized, I feel like. Maybe because Neil Gaiman is a more fully realized writer, you know, because it was based on his graphic novel. And, you know, Mark Miller, who wrote Wanted, and Wanted is very much the same kind of thing. I mean, when I saw that in theaters, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. I did. But now, I kind of hate that movie.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, and I hate it because it's because of the same reasons that I'm being critical of Kick-Ass. Granted, Kick-Ass is a lot better than Wanted. I mean, you know, because I think Matthew Vaughn had a much better handle of the funds and the actors, you know, and on all that. But, and yeah, I don't know, just, in a way it makes me sad. I don't know. Because you have people like Spike Jonze and Where the Wild Things that are kind of taking this ADD generation and calming it down while appeasing it. Mm-hmm. And then you have people like Matthew Vaughn who maybe are just going all out. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it makes you wonder, what are we looking forward to? And I just, you know, it's kind of scary in a way just because, you know, movies like, you know, these simpler films are just going to get lost because people don't have the patience for them. And so that, but anyway, I mean, that's
I mean, I think there's enough directors out there. It's not like every
true,
film
I mean, yeah, true,
be,
of course. But I'm just saying, like, you know, they're making an Avengers movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be fucking 1,000 villains and superheroes in a movie. It's getting made. Like, you know, and people are going to criticize it for the same reasons people are criticizing movies like this because there's nothing.
Iron Man 2, I'm kind of.
Right, well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, lest we not forget Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of where I think, you know, the wall hits Kick-Ass. But, I mean, that said, there are many great things. Mark Strong, for example, as the bad guy, the bad gangster, gives a great performance. You know, a Robert De Niro and Al Capone, Untouchables, worthy, over-the-top performance. And then on the other side, Nicolas Cage as Big Daddy gives kind of an equally Nicolas Cage over-the-top performance. Even though there's parts at the ends where I think it kind of goes askew. But definitely. So, you know, Aaron Johnson I'm not sold on yet. I'll say that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Like, we were talking, like, people talk about the marketing and stuff. Like, it's weird in the trailers. Like, it starts out with Aaron Johnson and ends with it. Like, they're trying to sell this movie. Like, we can talk all day about marketing and how they kind of, I don't think they did the best job they could.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know.
But,
like, how do you market that movie during the day? I don't know.
No, that is true. I just feel like you said, people aren't surprised. Like, people like us aren't surprised. When we go see, we know kind of what to expect. We've seen the Red Band trailers and stuff. But I actually feel like this is a movie where people at that. I mean, we had only made what, not 20 million at the box office.
20, yeah.
I feel this is a movie that people actually will be surprised at when they do go rent it on DVD or see. Because I mean, they are selling it kind of like the superhero teen comedy.
True.
The idea is there. It is the same. I mean, it's a superhero comedy, but they go to places where the trailer doesn't even really hint at.
Yeah.
I mean, but anyways, no, I do agree with you on your points about that. But
yeah, no, I mean you're right about the fact that I think if the everyday viewer would go to see it, they would find a similar experience in seeing it the way that we were talking about with, you know, going to see blockbusters back in the 70s or something,
yeah,
and being surprised, you know, because there wasn't the internet, and there wasn't, you know, 1,000, you know, fucking, you know, teaser clips.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da.
And I do, I mean, like we talk about, like, old blockbusters, like Raiders of the Lost Ark and stuff, I do feel Matthew Vaughn does structure the film pretty well in terms of the set pieces. Like,
true.
For a $30 million film, I mean, he... Like,
definitely.
Like, we... Like, you know, it starts out a very simple action scene in the street, and then by the end, I mean, we won't spoil it, but it's ridiculous. Like, right. each one kind of ramps up. And in terms of that, I think it delivers. Because a lot of movies these days, like, you know, like, we can even talk about Iron Man, the first one, like... It kind of, the best action sequence, like, the ending kind of disappointed me, whereas this movie,
of course.
It kind of keeps ramping up. And I thought it was hilarious. I mean, there's a lot of dark comedy aspects. Like, there's probably my favorite scene so far of the year, or one of my favorite scenes of the year is, you know, the first Hit Girl scene with the Banana Split song in it, when she first appears.
Right.
You know, I thought that, I love the way, the one thing about this movie, actually, I talked to our friend Joe Blodgett, who was on the Shutter Island podcast, but we were talking about the editing of this movie and how I actually really, really dug it, like, especially, like, scene transitions, but also the way, I mean, we talked, some movies are very music-driven, we've talked about that before, and this definitely is, but I think they do it very well. Like,
yeah, I mean, for the most part, I think they do it very well. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, I'll say this, I mean, the whole graphic novel adaptation thing, I feel like in general, I feel like comic books, graphic novels, they get away with murder in a lot of ways, right? Because, I mean, graphic novels are not novels, okay? They're movies, okay, that are on the page, they're frame by frame, and they're usually not good movies. Like, I'll be honest, like, I haven't read too much. But even shit like Sin City, right? Like, who made that movie great? I mean, it was the actors, and it was Robert Rodriguez. Like, I don't really think it was Frank Miller. I mean, yeah, the dialogue's really cute and pulpy and all that crap, but, like...
No, they transferred the style, definitely.
True, and, like, visually, right? Yeah. Visually, most of them are great. But I'm saying, as a full narrative, like, thing, like, very few of them really offer anything of original substance. I mean, very few. Like, I mean, even, I mean, like I was saying before with talking about Preacher, like, the thing about Preacher which bothers me is, yeah, it's a cool concept, but, like, that's, for me, all it seems comic books are cool concepts that just end up becoming the same fucking story. Like, if I'm wrong, please email me and tell me, give me a suggestion. But, like, is that not what we're reading here? Like, is Watchmen, I mean, and maybe this is just every story, I don't know, I mean, maybe you can make that Joseph Campbell argument, but, you know, like, Watchmen just becomes a post-apocalyptic morality play, okay, and then Kick-Ass just becomes a semi-satire on violence slash, you know, just a gore-loving action movie, okay, and then, you know, and then you have this going on, and I feel like, the reason that these movies end up shooting blanks in terms of watchability factors over and over and over is because there's not much to be read over and over from the source material. You know, I mean, like, I remember watching Watchmen and it making me sad even, because I enjoyed the film, but I remember it made me sad because it made me question the source material. It made me think, oh, maybe Alan Moore really didn't really offer something great.
Cool.
And that made me sad, you know, and, like, this movie... You know, well, truthfully, I never thought that. I mean, I really enjoyed reading Kick-Ass, but I never thought that it was, you know, God's gift or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I got the same excitement out of reading the graphic novel as I got the movie.
Right.
Like, it's just violent.
Right. A much more kind of appropriate adaptation, I guess, or equal adaptation in terms of experiences, at least. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just think something needs to be infused into this subgenre of graphic novel adaptations because.
I mean,
are you missing the mark by just a little bit.
I know you find, like, in terms of graphic novel, are you talking about also about, like, other superhero films? Or is it
comic books? I can definitely, for example, obviously, Dark Knight, you know, Dark Knight, even Iron Man, you know, those films, they found that thing, that X factor, that made people say, ah, you know, this is a movie I want to buy because I want to watch it over and over again, and not just fucking... Comic-Con people. I mean, people.
Yeah.
Like, real people. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't mean to be mean, but you know what I'm saying. Like, you know, friends
of ours.
Everyday people. And I think that needs to be breached, because in general, it's not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the thing. But I mean, on a pure entertainment level, Kick-Ass is a great one-time experience, you know, and I haven't seen it again, and if I do see it again and I love it more... I'll be sure to correct myself, you know, somehow. But yeah. So, I don't know. Yeah,
I agree. I mean, do you want to talk spoilers for like a little bit? Our favorite, yeah. I mean, our favorite things.
Yeah.
I mean, well, talking so spoilers coming up for Kick-Ass. Go see the movie. I would say definitely fun.
Yeah, definitely
one of the better ones in theaters now. Definitely over Clash of the Titans. I would say something like that. Something blockbuster wise. So.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no. So when we talk about the comic adaptation, and I was kind of looking back, I was kind of surprised. I mean, the comic is filled with blood. Like, it's ridiculous. And this movie is kind of, like, violence-wise, in terms of just strictly guns and stuff, like, and gunshots and explosions, like, that delivers. But I was actually surprised how little... There's blood. Like, don't get me wrong, there's blood.
There's a lot of blood, but they definitely space out the scenes appropriately.
I mean, did you, like... The one big change from... Probably the biggest change from the graphic novel and the comic is the Red Mist character. You find out early, very early on, which is I'm kind of glad they did, that he is actually Mark Strong's son.
Right.
And because in the comic, that was a huge reveal. That ended a chapter, an issue of the comic that he was turning against Kick-Ass, and that he was actually Mark Strong's son.
Right.
And stuff. And even his character, I don't know if I really liked him in the movie as much as I did in the comic.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the weaker aspects. Yeah. You know, I don't think Christopher Mintz-Plasse did a bad job. I just don't think he did a particularly great job. You know, I mean, his comedy kind of didn't really fit in the movie. Stuff like that. I mean, but I did like how they just kind of, you know, I mean, they had to change it, you know, because you can't.
Recognize him.
You can't introduce a character that you can recognize, and then it would just be confusing. You'd be like, oh, I mean, I guess the only thing would be if they made him, like, his character turn on his father in the beginning,
yeah,
and then become Red Mist, and then you found out later that it was
in the comic.
But that would be cheap, kind of, you know,
In the comic, though, I'm pretty sure you never, that, because in the movie, there's a relationship between him and his father, how he can't get into his business. That's not, obviously, in the movie at all. I mean, in the comic at all.
Not really,
and,
no.
And so, like, they could have done kind of a twist, I feel like. But they wouldn't have had his character really be in a big part. So that's
right, I mean, so, I don't know. I mean, I think it was a smart choice. Yeah. A decision I didn't like was they made the Nicolas Cage Big Daddy character an actual cop
who was actually
out for revenge, as opposed to what he was in the comics, which was a guy who was pretending to be a cop in front of his daughter who actually just loved comic books. But see, that's the satirical part that was not really that prevalent in the film, you know, and hence back to what we were talking about before.
Even the love story is kind of this, like, it's kind of this wish fulfillment thing. The whole movie's kind of like, you know, if you were to do this.
Well, that's the thing, the movie's wish fulfillment
at the end of the day. And they never, it just ends like that. It never is like the comic where it's like, you know, in the comic, the girl, he gets a text message from the girl that he loves, like, she's giving a blowjob to her ex-boyfriend, and, like, you know, and then he, like, jerks off to it. And, like, I mean, that's, like,
yeah,
sad
like a really
stuff.
Sad ending.
Yeah, and, like, I don't know if, like, obviously, you know, like, American audiences, most audiences wouldn't enjoy that, but I feel like if they wanted to go all out in terms of the satirical side, they could do that, but they went all out in terms of the blockbuster side.
And I mean, and I'll say, I very much enjoyed that change. You know, I thought that the girl was very beautiful, like, I liked that.
I did like it.
I liked that the good guy won, but you're right. I mean,
but it makes it a superhero movie at the end.
It makes it a superhero movie. Now, I mean, I guess that's what Matthew Vaughn wanted to do, but in that respect, those two respects, it does completely change it from the graphic novel, though it be an inherently faithful adaptation. So it's kind of interesting, you know. So it's a strange bird of a movie.
Yeah,
like
it really is,
and I think it's almost, you know, sad. This is going to sound really ignorant to say, but I think it's almost better to just almost not even think about it, just kind of go. And that's what I mean, masturbatory. Just do it.
I mean,
and fucking clean yourself up. You know what I mean?
The one thing I did really like about that, I mean, if you want to talk about a message in the movie, I did like, I mean, Deborah Ferracci pointed this out in his thing, how it's about this kid who, and it could be related to anything, like, you know, go, like, we're making a movie right now, make a movie, write a book, like, he just fucking goes out and does it, no matter if he fails. I mean, you can see him, he gets his ass kicked, he struggles with it, but he fucking, like, goes all out and does it. And I know, like, it's silly because it's kind of, the mold the story's in is kind of a silly, you know, crazy movie. But
is it not wish fulfillment that all these critics who spend, I mean, including ourselves, who spend most of their days on a computer writing about other people doing things,
yeah,
would go see a movie about a kid like them who instead of starting a film blog,
yeah,
and writing about movies like Kick-Ass, actually decided to become Kick-Ass. Yeah. Is that not just masturbatory? Yeah. Is that not just them literally watching a screen and, you know, yeah, their dicks aren't out, but essentially they're watching it and thinking, oh, God, if only, right? And, like, look, I put myself and you, Jordan, into that camp, and I'm not trying to. But, I mean, you know, look yourself in the mirror, you know, obviously, and recognize that, yeah, you can watch a movie about it, or you could just fucking, you can make a movie yourself. Like, do you need a movie to be made about that? That's kind of what I fall down on. But that's a good point, though. That is a good point. And, I mean, I think if, and as silly as you said it was, if in some place in this world, someone could watch this movie and be inspired to go out and hopefully not become a superhero because they'd probably die.
Beginning.
But if they have a dream or something to go out and, you know, become a doctor or become a filmmaker, then it would be the worth the price of admission, the price of, you know, anything.
Because a lot of people, we talked about how this movie might carry a big message, and that was the only one I really found, and it's not even that big, so that's what I'll
Yeah. But I mean, hey, it's there. It's there, and I mean, that's true. I mean, better the kid do things than not. I mean, I just hope that the kids who are watching this and deciding to dream big are over 15 years old.
What do you think of the jetpack? At the end.
I dug it.
I mean,
if we're talking wish fulfillment, fulfill that wish, baby, whatever.
And, I mean, some of the editing I love, like, the initial scene, Kick-Ass is trying to find his first, you know, kind of big, his big fight or big crime to solve, and then he finds a fly for a missing kid, and it's intercut with like this like fast paced chase scene, and they connect. And I really like the way you don't really see that because like most audiences would be like, oh, what's going on? That's really confusing. I don't like that. And the studio would have them change it.
True.
Like, you can tell that's the one thing about this movie. Like, you can tell that there isn't really test screenings.
They
made it, and then that's the movie we got, and which is awesome. Like, I'd rather see 100 movies like that.
True. I mean, that's a very good point.
And
I mean, it is a truly independent film.
And you know, I mean, we talked a little bit about Mark Strong, but he is definitely one of the greatest parts.
He's great. He's just continually great. Like, I'm excited to see Robin Hood in general, but that he plays Sir Godfrey makes me more excited.
He's not even really featured in the trailer, which is sad. Like,
you know, who knows?
He's there, but he's there.
I mean, it's a fucking epic adventure. He might be in it for an hour. Who knows? You know, it's like not. But you know, I mean, Kate Blanchett's in that trailer for like 2 seconds, and she's Maid Marian. So. We'll see.
And, Chloe Moretz, like everyone's saying.
True, I mean, I'm excited to see what she's next.
Yeah.
I don't know that she, you know, like, I mean, Hit Girl's iconic. Just because of the pure, that occurs. But, I mean, I imagine she could probably deliver better performances.
Yeah.
And I look forward to her and Let Me In, Hugo Cabret.
Definitely.
What have you. So I am very... Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Just kidding. So yeah, I mean, I'm excited. I mean, she is a rising star.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say, you know, wrap it up.
Yeah, it's right.
I would say definitely check out this movie. I personally loved it. I would definitely be getting on Blu-ray. Oh, one thing, the production design I love. For a movie like this, like everything, every frame is like perfectly kind of constructed. And even the colors, like beautiful. Beautiful
movie.
But yeah, one other thing I wanted to talk about is the way they do action scenes. You know, a lot of movies nowadays, we get the Bourne style kind of, the editing is what drives the action, not the action itself. And with this movie, I feel like Matthew Vaughn, he kind of pulls it back a little bit, and we get to see everything that's happening. We have a sense of all the characters, and like,
heads getting cut off.
Yeah, and I love that. And so I did a great job with all that stuff. I would definitely highly, highly recommend this. And I totally agree with Dan. You know, I don't think this isn't a class. Like, it's not a movie I laughed at. Like, wow, that is an immediate classic. And I will, you know.
Right.
But it is a movie I will probably rewatch many times. And check it out. I want to do a quick mention. Next week is we have The Losers. Which we're actually
seeing
tomorrow night. And then Oceans, which I loved Earth. I know a lot of people they saw Planet. See, I've never seen Planet Earth, any of it really.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, it's just a rehash of Planet Earth, which is what it was. But I mean, this is a brand new Ocean. This is a brand new movie, and it's getting some good early buzz, beautiful.
And the backup plan,
Which we missed our screening. It's going on right now.
Whoops.
33 minutes into the back of the plane. After extraordinary measures, CBS Films is going to try really hard. to get me back in the theater. But, I mean, I hope losers, I would think they would probably win.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the hype's been really nice, so we'll see.
But yeah, so we will be back next week with Oceans and the Losers review. And, in the meantime, you can follow, I'll give us our Twitters again, twitter.com/thefilmstage.
twitter.com/DJMecca.
And if you enjoy the podcast, definitely tell your friends about it and subscribe on iTunes. It's right in this post, and you'll get it delivered every week. And so we'll be back next week to talk about Oceans and the Losers.